This is not just any podcast. This is Historical Inaccuracies, a history podcast.
Good morning.
Morning.
Morning all.
Shall I get started then, sorry?
Yes, please.
Okie dokie, right.
Oh wait, but you have to do the M&S thing first.
Right. Hello, and welcome to another exciting episode of the podcast, Historically Inaccurate. Today, we are
that
going
is,
to
I'm sorry,
be...
that is not that is... how I sound, that's terrible.
That's amazing!
I love
yes,
that.
Yes it is, that's exactly how you sound!
I do not sound that constipated.
I think you do.
Oh, thank you, friend. Thank
I'm
you
sorry.
So much.
Okay, right. Okay, I'll take it again. I can't do it. You've got the husky voice. I just sound like a fucking idiot.
I just think comedy value, that's amazing.
I really can't, but okay, I'll try my hardest. Hello, and welcome to another interesting podcast of Historically Inaccurate. For those of you who don't know, we are four friends, two Scots, a Greek, and an English lady, discussing various topics on history. And today, our topic is on King James VI of Scotland and King James I of England. So in addition to this, our historical fact of the day is in 1081, Alexios Komnenos became...
It's a Greek one. I had to stop you there. Alexios Komnenos. Thank you. Sorry.
Alexios Komnenos. Is that right? I don't know. Yes. Yep. Thank. Okay. Efaristo. He became emperor of the Eastern Roman Empire, aka the Byzantine Empire. So that's our wee historical fact of the day.
Thank you very much for mentioning my fellow men. Thank you.
That's okay. So the reason why we're discussing King James VI of Scotland, King James I of England, is because some of us seem to think that he's a bit of a dick. And, well, actually, all of us think he's a bit of a dick, to be honest. We are trying very hard to find nice things about him, but it turns out he is actually a bit of a wanker. So, without further ado, I would like to pass you over to Becky, our English Rose, who will give us a brief introduction of King James VI and King James I of England.
James the Sixth, this is your life. So James the Sixth, born on the 19th of June 1566 to the ill-fated Mary Queen of Scots and Lord Darnley, who, by the way, was her cousin, in case you didn't realise, which I personally think is a bit iffy, but there we go.
I think that'll also probably be part of the reason why he turned out to be a garbage man.
Yeah, well, that's why cousins don't marry.
Well, yes, exactly. He was baptised in December of the same year at Stirling Castle, and his godparents were, shall we say, an interesting bunch. You had Charles IX of France, who it was Mary Queen of Scots' former brother-in-law, Elizabeth I of England, and the Duke of Savoy, although all were represented by other people at the event. 10th of February 1567, Darnley was found out of the house, away from the explosion, potentially having been strangled. 15th of May 1567, Mary Queen of Scots married James Hepburn, Earl of Bothwell, again in very suspicious circumstances. Hepburn was suspected of being involved in the murder, or potential murder, of Lord Darnley, and this increased ill feelings towards Mary. After the disastrous Carbery Hill not-quite battle in June 1567, Mary was imprisoned at Lochleven Castle by Protestant rebels, and in July 1567, she was forced to abdicate in favour of young James. Now, at this point, he's only about 13 months. So, obviously, at this point, he has a regent, and he goes through a fair few regents during the early part of his reign. The first one is James Stuart, Earl of Murray, who is his illegitimate uncle and a member of the Lords of Congregation, who are a bunch of Protestant nobles who have... or who will be very instrumental in the future of Scotland. 29th of July 1567, he is anointed king at the Church of the Holy Rood by the Bishop of Orkney. The Church of the Holy Rood is in Stirling, and Interesting pub quiz fact. There are only two churches in the UK that have seen the crowning of a monarch and are still in use. And that is, of course, Westminster and the Church of the Holy Rood. So, I mean, I have no idea if that's going to come in a pub quiz, but if it does, you know the answer.
There's another, I've got another wee fun pub fact quiz, just with you mentioning James's uncle, Mayor of Queen of Scots' half-brother. Did you know he was the first person to be documented to be assassinated by firearm?
Oh, wow.
I did not know that, but that is really cool.
Fun fact.
Oh, well, thank you for that. But what's particularly remarkable is when James was anointed king, he was anointed king knowing that he would be raised Protestant. And this is remarkable because barely 10 years beforehand, only around 10% of Scotland was Protestant. So the fact that now the king was going to be raised Protestant is pretty remarkable. As well as that, in 1560, the Scottish Parliament had renounced the Pope's authority and Mass was declared illegal. So this is a very turbulent time, and having a 13-month-old crowned on the throne wasn't necessarily the most stable of things, but there we go. So his tutor was announced to be George Buchan, who was a Renaissance scholar and was also Mary Queen of Scots court poet. As he grew, James shared his tutor's enthusiasm for Latin and Protestantism, but later rejected Buchanan's idea of kingship being subject to law. In 1579, and this is, I would argue, a pivotal point in James's life, was the arrival of his second cousin, Esme Stuart, who was a guy, by the way, who later became the Earl of Lennox from France. And this is important because Lennox quickly became one of James's favourites. And James is known for having had favourites throughout his life.
He had, was it George Villiers was his other, the Earl of Buckingham?
Yes.
Both of them.
When he went down to England. One of their contemporaries noted that when Lennox and James were together, Lennox would draw the king to carnal lust. Which is a particularly excitable way of putting it, let's put it.
Especially for the early 1600s.
And am I right in thinking he was calling them, one of them, his wife in one of the letters that he wrote to them?
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, yes.
Kelly Cam, have you heard this?
Ooh.
I've not heard about the what? Oh, no, it was just to say I hadn't heard about I'm calling one of them his wife, but I have heard that they found a secret passage that connected James's chambers with the Earl of Buckingham's chambers at one of the castles. So, yeah, that was just my little nugget.
Oi, oi.
Mm-hmm. Wank, wank.
I honestly thought you said wank, wank there.
Same.
Not wink.
Well, wink. You know.
Oh, God.
I have read that there was a possibility he may have been or had affinity for men, but I don't think it was really ever kind of proven. Obviously, you had the letters, it's kind of like Maria's just mentioned, but that's the first time I've ever heard of anything like that at all, actually. So it is quite interesting. Although, to be fair, it's probably not surprising, but I would have had to have... hidden it quite well. And I suppose if he had like a secret passage, etc., probably would have done them quite well.
There was there's evidence as well. Some people think that he also had mistresses, though. So one of them having the same name as my auntie, shout out to my auntie, Anne Murray. So that was the most interesting thing that stuck with me. So it could have been by, like, it, I mean, obviously it's hard for us to know in this modern society what people in early 1600s sexual preferences were or how they would identify themselves. So but as I've always said, when it's funny whenever we talk about this and about the evidence that exists that he could possibly have had an interest in men, like, he was still a garbage man. That does not change, like, my perception of him whatsoever.
I think I found the passage, by the way, if you're interested in hearing a bit snippet of the letter.
Oh, yes, please.
Please.
So in a 1623 letter
James refers bluntly to marriage and calls Buckingham his wife, and the passage says, "I cannot content myself without sending you this present, praying God that I may have a joyful and comfortable meeting with you, and that we may make at this Christmas a new marriage ever to be kept hereafter. I desire to live only in this world for your sake, and that I had rather live banished in any part of the earth with you than live a sorrow widow's life without you. And may so God bless you, my sweet child and wife, and grant you ye may ever be a comfort to your dead dad and husband."
Can I just say, Maria, that your voice is just so beautiful reading that letter. I feel like you read that way better than he would ever have read it.
Thank you very much for that. It was the passion emanating from the words that made it. Actually, it's quite romantic, isn't it?
Very romantic.
It is, yes, but that, you know, I'm not taking that anything away from him being an arse, but that was...
Oh, no, it was still garbage.
Indeed.
Okay, so, although Lennox was a convert to Protestantism, there were some nobles that were concerned that he wasn't fully converted, and this is vitally important because this then leads in August 1582 to the Ruthven raid, and Kelly knows my feelings on the Ruthvens, so but
oh yes
I'll go into that possibly later, but anyway, so the Earls of Gowrie and Angus lured James to Gowrie's seat at Ruthven Castle, which is now Huntingtail Castle. Shout out to Huntingtail Castle. If you haven't been, you should go. And imprisoned him and forced Lennox to leave Scotland. Now, the king was held for 10 months. The conspirators wanted to control the king, and by removing any access to the outside world, that was exactly what they did. But this in particular is important, firstly because the young king was really very young at this stage. When he realised that he couldn't leave, the king burst into tears. I mean, he was only a teenager at this point. You know, it must have been absolutely terrifying. And the master of Glamis, who was also there, is reputed to have said, "Better bairns greet than bearded men." And James has said never to have forgotten this absolute slur. But the reason that this is particularly important is because all of the people that were involved, the Protestant lords, they did this because they wanted to limit James's access to people they saw as outsiders, i.e. Catholic sympathisers or Catholics. But the Earl of Gowrie at this stage had already been implicated in the murder of David Rizzio. He had been implicated in Mary Queen of Scots' imprisonment at Lochleven, and also apparently declared his love for her then. Take that as you will, and was also the Treasurer of Scotland. So he was an incredibly important man, both in terms of Scottish history, now Scottish culture, and the general running of the country. In June 1583, James escapes, and although he initially forgives Gowrie, in May the next year, Gowrie was beheaded at Stirling Castle. 1586, very importantly, was the Treaty of Berwick, which was a mutual defensive alliance pact to guarantee aid should an invasion of either Protestant Scotland or Protestant England take place. What's interesting to me is that in 1588, during the Spanish Armada, James wrote to Elizabeth I of his support as your natural son and compatriot of your country, which, I don't know, seems a bit... interesting for the King of Scotland, but there we go. So, more importantly for what Kelly is going to talk about later, in August 1589, James married Anne of Denmark by proxy. And Anne's sailing, post-wedding from Denmark, was disrupted by storms and she was forced to divert to Norway. And in a particularly romantic episode, James sailed to Norway to fetch her. They had an official wedding in Oslo and then honeymooned in Denmark, which I personally think sounds quite nice. But it was there where James first saw the witch trials of women accused of summoning the storms which endangered the Queen's life. And this really affected James and led to the North Berwick witch trials in 1590. And in 1597, demonology was published. I feel like I'm just talking and talking and talking, so I really apologise, guys.
Could I just interject there?
Of course. Please.
With regards to the demonology, I've actually had a read of it, and it's actually a really interesting kind of like treatise. So basically, James had attempted to analyze kind of like, you know, magic and its effect upon people. And one of the things I was reading was, it was really interesting. It was in the Demonology book, and it was chapter 3. And it was the comparisons between different magic and the classifications of the demons. That's what the whole book was really about. But in chapter 3, it's really interesting. So this was about the devil possessing people. And there's a really interesting quote that I got from it. And it was, "For if he is permitted to enter in bodies, even when they are annoyed with the soul, how much more will God permit him to enter in their dead carrions, which is no more man, but the filthy and corruptible case of man? For as Christ saith, it is not anything that enters within man that defiles him, but only that which proceeds and cometh out of him." So I just thought it was actually quite interesting, as kind of Becky had just mentioned, that when he was being schooled, he was, you know, he was fluent in Latin, etc. But he seemed to be quite a learned man as well. And demonology is, anyone wants to read it, I would certainly give it a read. It's quite interesting.
It's an interesting insight into a particular mindset as well. But when you read through it, at times it's just so fanatical that you just feel sorry for the people that lived under him, because he essentially wrote, it was essentially a manual for witchcraft, but there's a little bit, there was an interesting thing I found out in particularly regarding when James came to England regarding demonology, but I will put a pin in that until I take you through my why James is a garbage man segment.
Oh, you tease, you. So in 1600, our friends, the Earl of Gowrie, is back. Now, this is the son of the Earl of Gowrie who was beheaded. And, I mean, I'll try not to go too much into it, but the whole thing is shrouded in doubt. And the king, obviously, was the victor. So his version of events, he was out hunting at Falkland Palace and was enticed to visit the Earl of Gowrie's home by his brother to inspect a pot of gold, which could have been used for a Catholic plot. And this is where it starts to get confusing, because the Earl's brother invited him and the king arrived at Gowrie House, but the Earl didn't seem to have any clue that the king was arriving. They had food, had a chat, and then the Earl's brother took the king upstairs to view the pot of gold, and I'm doing the bunny ears thing there. And after that, locked the king in the turret room and tried to kill him. Now, the king was subsequently rescued, but in the scuffle, both Gowrie and his brother were killed. After that, James then really became properly paranoid, and it kind of affected him mentally for a very, very long time afterwards. But anyway, back to happier things. 1603, accession to the English throne. Woo! 1604, peace treaty between Spain and England, effectively ending the Anglo-Spanish War. Very important. 1605, gunpowder plot. I think we all know about that, so I won't go into that. 1606, the Popish Resurgence Act. I think that's how you say that. Required any subject when asked to swear an oath of allegiance denying the Pope's authority over the king. 1611, publication of the authorised King James the Bible, which is still used today.
Can I just ask, maybe this is just because I come from a Catholic background, but what is the difference between, like, what additions were made or what different things that does the King James Bible have, just having never known much about it?
Well, see, here's the thing, because coming from the other side of that, coming from a Protestant Anglican background, I couldn't tell you because I've never read a Catholic Bible. And so I have no idea what the difference is. If anybody else knows, I'm more than happy to listen.
I had always kind of thought that one of the major differences between them was that there were actually certain parts of the King James Bible that had just been made up.
Oh, on a whim. That James had made it up.
I don't know if it was James or if it'd been somebody else because that had perhaps helped him out with it, but they just added bits into it just to make it sound better, apparently.
That reminds me of the Darrow Brain sketch that they put a gazebo at the back of it. I don't know if you've ever seen his sketch that he does about the differences between Catholics and Protestants.
And the Catholics sat down early and the Protestants were all standing, still doing a prayer.
They're still going!
If you want a bit of background about the actual Bible, it was published, in, as Becky said, in 1611, and it involved no fewer than 54 scholars, and it was overseen by a commission of 12. And it does remain, as per critics, modern and of the time, one of the masterpieces of English literature and a tribute to the art of the committee. And as a Victorian theologian said, it lives on the ear like music that can never be forgotten, like the sound of church bells, which the convert hardly knows how he can forget.
I mean, they've clearly not read it in a modern context because it's dull as dishwater. But okay.
I wonder what the Catholic reaction to it was. Or is.
I had always assumed that Mass had largely been done in Latin up until, I mean, not everywhere, but most kind of like churches and chapels had done Mass in Latin right up until the 1960s, I think it was, and I believe it was a Pope in the 1960s that changed it from kind of Latin for it to be in almost any language. So I can imagine it going from Latin, which was the established language of the church almost, or the Roman Catholic Church is, into kind of English. I don't know how happy they would have been. It'd be interesting to see what their thoughts were at the time.
Yeah, definitely. That's something to take away, I think.
Well, that's definitely a good point, because I do remember reading that the one of the mainstays of young... I say new Protestantism was that it was in English, not in Latin, to make it more accessible, which I think was possibly a kind of, in a very cynical viewpoint, to encourage people to then take this Protestantism on board and to be able to understand it more than they understood Catholicism, which they wouldn't necessarily do because not everybody even wrote, let alone understood Latin. So that would make sense.
Yeah, definitely.
So, 1617, and I'm sure Kelly will talk about this later, James returns to Scotland, the only time that he returned to Scotland after his accession to the English throne. In 1619, Queen Anne died, and in 1625, James VI of Scotland, first of England, suffered a stroke and died.
So moving on, the devil on your shoulder. Kelly, would you like to start us off, please?
Oh yes, right now. I feel like this should be like you know that song, A Moment Like This? Copyright whoever wrote that song that Leona Lewis won the X Factor with in whatever year. Because I have much feelings about how James was a garbage man, and I'm sure I've talked about it many times to people that I know. So this is me officially putting it on record that I hate James the Sixth. And I think this is what we were originally going to call our podcast as well, We Hate James the Sixth, because we all do. But yeah, this hatred has been ongoing for quite a few years since I started reading more about the man. So I guess the main thing to cover in why James the Sixth was a garbage man is his obsession and persecution of who he deemed to be witches. So I think I mentioned it earlier on, I don't want to go too much into this because we'll be here all day. To be honest, James and his obsession with witches could be an entire episode in and of itself. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about the North Berwick witch trials, which Becky had mentioned, which were the first prolific, they were the first prolific witch trials in Scotland and UK as a whole, I think, as well, or the modern UK as we know it. So basically, as Becky had mentioned, it started with Anne of Denmark, the storms that were raised during her sailing over to Denmark, and then James falling over to Denmark, and then the both of them came back on a ship through to Leith, and there was storms again. Now by this point, James had witnessed the witch trials in Denmark, as Becky mentioned. And when he got to Leith, he was convinced that the reason that the storms had been summoned must have been because there were witches that were gathering the storms to wreck his new bride's entry in Edinburgh. So what essentially ended up happening was that he rounded up, and I say he because this is the only, I'm pretty sure it's the only case of a monarch being directly involved in a trial and the torture of those involved in a trial. I think it was about 70 people were rounded up purely from East Lothian, so from North Berwick, Humbay, Preston Pans, as we know them now, very local areas to where I stay anyway, and he rounded them all up. One thing as well is they weren't all women. There was a schoolmaster, a Dr. John Fian, who was a man who was also implicated in these witch trials as well. But in terms of time, I think the most notable one was a lady called Agnes Sampson. And Agnes was, I think she was about 80, so she was an older lady. And they believed that her interrogation was very well documented. So, and James personally oversaw her interrogation as well. So one of the accounts that I was looking into described Agnes when she was brought in front of the king and accused of summoning the storms and having a pact with the devil and all of, you know, the juicy, what we would think now is psychotic charges. The witness said that she, in quotes, stood stiffly in denial of the charges against her, and she would not relent, and when she didn't relent, James ordered that she had all of the hair on her body shaved off, stripped naked. Her head was wrenched with a rope, which was a typical Scottish torture method at the time, pulled tighter and tighter and tighter until it was crushing her skull. This happened for more than an hour while, quote, the king watched with great delight, end quote.
Well, that's just sick.
Which tells you everything you need to know about James. Now, this is just one of the many witch trials that he personally oversaw personally oversaw their interrogations. Now, when they say interrogations, they mean they were tortured for the information. So naturally, all of them confessed, as is always the case in witch trials. You know, Agnes Sampson said that, you know, she met the devil at the Old Kirk in North Berwick. I don't know if anyone's been to the Old Kirk at North Berwick and seen where this allegedly happened. But it's quite an understated wee place. But you can go and visit it today. So shout out if anyone wants to go to North Berwick and see it. Agnes did eventually confess, even though at first she was very resolutely in denial of the charges. After a good, well, don't know how long she was tortured for, she admitted it. And then, along with however many others, some names included like Gilly Duncan, who, if anyone watches Outlander, she's a character in Outlander at one point, and John Fian, just a lot. There was up to about 70 people that had this met this fate. So Agnes was then eventually garrotted, which means she was strangled and burned on the castle esplanade. And the Edinburgh, the old toll booth in Edinburgh recorded the cost of Agnes's execution as six Scots shillings, if I remember rightly. That could be wrong, but they've got a note of her execution, so that's how they know she was definitely executed. So yeah, that's a kind of quick run up that kind of I feel that just by looking at what happened to Agnes and her particular interrogation, that can tell you all you need to know, because James didn't just do that for her. He sat in for pretty much all of them, and there was about 70 of them who were accused. That is a lot of torture for someone to enjoy and to sit and watch. And Scottish torture methods were pretty inventive. Which kind of takes me on to the next point that I was going to talk about. So the North Berwick witch trials had obviously happened. This led to James writing demonology from what he observed, which became essentially the manual for torturing people accused of witchcraft, as well as, you know, outlining the forms of magic and the different supernatural threats that exist in the world. So when James became King of England in 1603, one of the most interesting things to me that I noted was that England was much more, up until that point under Elizabeth, was much more ambivalent towards the subject of witchcraft than other countries, and especially Scotland. So the number of, there was still cases of witchcraft in England during the Elizabethan reign, during the Elizabethan time, but there were much significantly less than what had happened in Scotland during and after the Northberic witch trials. The punishments in Elizabethan England for those who were accused of witchcraft were also much more lenient. For example, and this is the most interesting thing that I found as well. So in England, torture was not generally practiced unless it was for an accusation of high treason. So under English law at that time, those who were accused of witchcraft weren't generally tortured. Obviously, that's as far as records go. I mean, it could well have happened just off the books, but as far as the records go, people in England who were accused of witchcraft were not generally tortured into a confession, and the punishments were a lot more lenient. For example, they would never put someone to death just for, you know, accusation. So if, like in Scotland, for example, if someone was found to have the devil's mark, which is what we would know now as a birthmark or a mole or some kind of a blemish, if you like, on the body, as they saw it, then that would be enough to condemn a person to death. Whereas in England, that didn't happen. At that point, they weren't generally killed for being accused of witchcraft.
Always found that the whole if you've got a freckle or a mole thing really interesting, because as a people, we are we have a kind of a predilection for having freckles and moles. We are a very moly people.
moly people.
I just find that completely ridiculous, that the curse of people from the British Isles, although obviously it happens everywhere, is something that apparently means that we're witches. In that instance, we would all be witches, you know?
Well, it's just like, they're just, but in that case, it's like they're just looking for something which they would see as proof for what they've already accused them of doing. So it's like if someone was accused of having been seen dancing naked on the hillside at a full moon, then if you inspected them and they had like a strange freckle or whatever, then that was proof that would go along with their act, basically. But yeah, I found it just interesting the fact that before, this is another thing that James brought to England, was this obsessive violence-based approach towards witchcraft, or what he deemed to be witchcraft, and persecuting people who were accused of it. Because towards the end of the Elizabethan era, witchcraft trials in England were virtually non-existent. They had declined so much, and even to begin with, there wasn't a huge amount of them. And in England, most notably, and I think this still happened after James became king, because he tried to get it changed and he couldn't, I'm pretty sure. But in England, convicted witches were hanged rather than burned, whereas in Scotland they were burned, which obviously a lot of people would see as a more tame death and a much more, definitely a much less a less painful death. I think most people would agree than being burned alive, but.
Definitely agreed.
But yeah, so that is something that James wanted to change, but it didn't happen. So I'm assuming that he was blocked in some way from putting that into effect when he came into England, down to England. So when he became king of England as well, demonology. So as soon as he got down to England, he thought, you know what, these people are just far too lenient towards witchcraft. They're not caring enough about witchcraft like what they should be. And the first thing that he did, within the first year of his reign in England, he replaced the Elizabethan statute on witchcraft and made it harsher. And part of the harsher rules that he put in place was that the death penalty was introduced for people who were accused of witchcraft and they were found to have the devil's mark. And also demonology was reprinted twice within the first year of him becoming king in England. So it was very much used as a propaganda campaign down in England to try and get people to get on board his train of being like, we need to be paranoid about witches, we need to seek people out. And yeah, he essentially brought his own paranoia down and spread it through England, which obviously eventually led to the Pendle witch trials, to Matthew Hopkins, Witchfinder General, everything, all of... Most cases of witchcraft in England in the medieval period definitely stemmed from James, who brought this kind of way of thinking down with him when he became king. So that's an interesting and very much a reason for him being just, well, we know that I think he's a garbage man anyway, but...
I feel like that's the first time that the English have ever been described as laid back.
Well, yeah, you know, it's ironic, I think, because, you know, a lot of the kind of perceptions that people have, a lot of them were actually brought by James. So I think a lot of it is, we've got, you guys basically have him to thank for a lot of your bad name. So, but... Yeah,
it's not the English, it's all James VI's fault. We're innocent.
Yeah, well, it was he definitely brought a certain new wave of violence. Now, when you think about it in England as well, particularly during the Elizabethan reign, Catholic persecution was at an all-time high. And if you think about James coming down and then suddenly bringing a new wave of persecution in forms of... what he perceived to be witchcraft, then yeah, it just would not have been a nice place to have lived at that point. So yeah, that is, there's so much more that you could go into about James and witchcraft, but that was the main thing that I found that I didn't know, was the fact that England was so lenient before he came, or much more lenient. I wouldn't go as fast to say it was very lenient, because it was still the medieval period, but he definitely made it harsher and brought down a lot of the rules that he had inflicted in Scotland. And another interesting thing as well, in Scotland, women were tortured, whereas in England, that was seen as, you know, inappropriate. So women weren't tortured in England generally before that point as well. So, yeah. Yay, James. Thanks for that. Just spreading your psychotic tendencies into, like, different countries. But, yeah, so in terms of witches... That is a kind of brief runaround of why I despise the man. But anyway, another reason, now this is new. I did not know this, so in all of my rants about James, this is a new thing that I had not come across, and then when I seen it, I was like, you know what? That makes me hate the man even more. So I don't know if any of you have heard about something called the Lordship of the Isles.
I have. I've read quite a bit about the Statutes of Iona. It's terrible. Essentially, basically, these were a set of laws and provisions that essentially kind of not almost destroyed, but it severely weakened kind of Gaelic culture.
Yep.
And it also tied in as well with the plantations of Ulster as well. I'll let you go ahead. I'll do my bit in a wee second.
Sorry. I've only touched on it really briefly, so definitely, if you've got more information, that would be really good. The Lordship of the Isles in relation to James VI, though, what I found was James VI declared himself as ruler of the Lordship of the Isles, and he declared himself as the Lord of the Isles over Clan MacLeod, who were the clan who ruled. Now, at that time, the Hebrides and the Isles were pretty much independent from Scotland as in so much as they were self-governing, and there was particularly with the Reformation, there was quite a big gap between what they perceived to be, you know, the Catholic, Gaelic, clan-based islands and the Protestant lowlands. So basically the division was deepening. It was quite a kind of opposite. There was two sort of opposite sides, if you like. And James decided that he wanted the Lordship of the Isles to be absolved under his rule. So what he did was he sent, in 1598, he sent a group called the Gentlemen Adventurers of Fife, which I just thought it was, I mean, obviously what happens is horrible, but the fact that they went by the Gentlemen Adventurers of Fife, like, oh yes, we are the Gentlemen Adventurers of Fife, we're going to come and colonise your islands. So yeah, he essentially sent them with the sole purpose of sacking the Isle of Lewis. And originally, James wanted the Gentlemen Adventurers of Fife to slaughter every man, woman and child on the island. But he was convinced otherwise by his nobles. So it had to be talked down from genocide on that island, pretty much. Whoever did that, I don't know who they were, but They didn't slaughter every man, woman and child on the island. They did, however, slaughter a decent amount of them, and they set up a settlement there. They also, now the reason, the justification that James gave for attacking the Isle of Lewis and the Hebrides at large was the Clan MacLeod had betrayed, he felt betrayed by the Clan MacLeod, because now this just, this makes me just think, was the man a Gemini? I don't know if he was, but this is like one thing that that's come up in reading about James is just his duplicitness and how he, you know, very much two-faced in a lot of ways, it at least comes across. So he deemed, previous to this point, the Clan MacLeod, who was the Lord of the Isles, the chieftain was Lord of the Isles, he had entered into a, quote, traitorous pact with England to attack Scotland. Previous to this point. So that was James's justification for attacking the Lord, the islands, and making himself Lord of the Isles, was that they were traitors for allying themselves with the English, which is pretty ironic considering James later basically essentially turning his back on Scotland to be all about everything English. The fact that he used that as justification just kind of shows how empty the man's reasoning was. So once they had colonised the Isle of Lewis, the gentlemen adventurers of Fife did come back, but it didn't stop. There was further attacks on the islands, and James's sole purpose in doing this was to, quote, eradicate Gaelic culture, very much similar to the plantation of Ulster, like Cammy mentioned. And he wanted to essentially bring them in line with the Protestant lowland society. And one of the other things that he did was he had the son and heir of the chieftain or ex-lord of the Isles brought to Edinburgh, put on trial for high treason, and he was hanged in the Grassmarket because he was not considered worthy of a nobleman's execution. His head was cut off post-mortem and then displayed in Edinburgh as a warning, if you like. And pretty much the main thing that I gathered from this is, you know, this was very much, you know, when we talk about the Jacobites in Culloden and the cultural genocide of Gaelic culture that happened after the Battle of Culloden, but this was very much the foundations of that. This happened, this was an internal job that started with James a long time before Culloden happened. So that was quite a disturbing fact that I kind of learned and gave me just another extra fuel to the fire of James' hatred. I don't know what people think about that, but I was just very much, it was quite a horrible thing to realise that he essentially was the spearhead of eradicating that culture.
One thing that's actually really interesting that I've been kind of reading up about is James's predecessors, so James V and James IV. They most likely, I mean, certainly James IV anyway, fluently spoke Gaelic, and James V would have had some knowledge of it as well. And it's quite interesting to see that kind of there was a culture in Scotland that really kind of supported the, you know, the Gaelic culture, because it was seen as kind of like the original bastion of kind of Christian faith in Scotland. You know, you had, you know, Iona, which was at one point the centre of kind of Christianity in Scotland as well. And it's interesting to see the kind of development of Gaelic being supported, being quite honoured for it, moving towards when James VI kind of comes to the throne, it being known as Irish. So it being known as like a foreign language, something that's not distinctively Scottish, which is really interesting. But to go back to one of your points, so Kelly, I was going to mention about the Statutes of Iona. This was enacted in 1609. One of the very interesting things that they did was clan chiefs had to provide help to Protestant ministers. So essentially what they would do is the clan chiefs were required to pay and support the Protestant religion by establishing parishes. And within these parishes, largely the Gaelic language was forbidden to have been spoken about. It was all meant to be in English, largely. Another interesting aspect of this, of the statute as well, was the outlawing of bearers and bards of traditional Gaelic culture. Now, from my own kind of understanding of Gaelic culture, and I always remember my grandmother actually mentioned this to me, was that when you went to school, I mean, this is obviously going, this isn't the 1600s, just to kind of like clarify this was going back maybe to like the 50s and the 60s, even maybe to the kind of 40s. Remember, Graham mentioned this. Gaelic was really only for when you spoke at home. If you spoke it in the school, you would often get beaten. So it's interesting to kind of see that this kind of this attitude that established, you know, hundreds of years ago, kind of largely continued even up until quite recently. You know, the outlaw, and going back to my point though about the outlaw of bearers of traditional Gaelic culture, you know, really kind of suppressed, you know, the Gaelic language. And a very interesting point as well was the prohibition of import and the sale of wine and whiskey except for Lowlander Scots. I think this is actually quite an interesting point, because when people kind of think of Scotland, you know, whiskey is quite an important part of Scottish culture, certainly as a food and a drink. So I just kind of thought it was actually quite interesting, because when a lot of people think of kind of whiskey, you know, people kind of think of the best whiskey coming from either the Highlands and the Islands, etc., you know, like Jura, you know, so many to name. Mm-hmm. I just thought it was quite interesting that this was actually prohibited to have been sold and imported by the people traditionally would make it, except to Lowlander Scots.
Yeah, it's very ironic, I think.
It is.
I think as well, just in terms of, like, again, when you see more about these things and you see how it very much came from within, so I think a lot of the time England, shout out Becky, gets quite a, you know, labelled as particularly with relation to Gaelic culture and following up from Culloden as being the primary force behind the eradication of Gaelic culture. But really it started much earlier than that. It started with James, essentially. And that was before it became King of England. So, yeah, there's definitely a lot to think about there. But it was definitely a horrible extra thing that he did that I wasn't really aware of that much until this point. So, yeah, shout out to James for being yet again a d-bag.
He isn't.
Yes, but yeah, just to quickly, I don't want to like keep going for too long. But there's just a couple of two last sort of things I was just going to run over in my little devil on your shoulder section. The first one, very briefly, was just as Becky had mentioned earlier, when James became King of England, 1603, and he left Edinburgh. He left with a promise to return every 3 years at the very least. They only came back once in 1617, as Becky mentioned. So what he did, I mean, I tried to find a little bit more information on this, but there's not actually that much there. But there's a significant evidence that when he left Edinburgh, not only the city itself in particular, but also Scotland, it had based itself so much around his rule. He'd been ruling there for, you know, since he was a child. And so much of the infrastructure was based around the king being in Edinburgh and being in Scotland. And obviously, when he left, that all, you know, it was very, if we think about how unsettling that would have been if your entire life was based around, you know, there may be people that had jobs there, people that, you know, whose their essential livelihoods revolved around the king's role in being in the Scottish court. But when he did leave, he left the Privy Council in charge of Scotland, which is kind of similar to the Privy Council were set up, I think, during Mary Queen of Scots' regency, possibly, I think. Because obviously she was also, she was 6 days old when she became queen, so they needed the country was run by a regent and a council, a privy council, which is where the privy council began, and they kept it as being the king's main advisory board as well from that point on. So the privy council in Scotland were left in charge when James left to go to Edinburgh. Left Edinburgh to go to London, and this just made my blood boil. When James was in London, he boasted, now this has been noted as a quote, he boasted while he was in London ruling that he could rule Scotland, quote, by my pen. So he didn't have to go to Scotland to rule them, he could just send a letter to the Privy Council and whatever he said the Privy Council would enact to the letter. Now obviously if you think about the fact that I don't know how long it would have taken for a messenger to ride with James's letters from London to Edinburgh, it would be a decent amount of time anyway back then if you were going on horseback. So whenever the Privy Council were making decisions and in very important decisions, or wanting to make very important decisions in Scotland, they had to wait. There was a huge delay between them actually being able to carry out their duties and actually receiving confirmation from the king. So yeah, essentially Scotland became a secondary nation to him, essentially. But yeah, that just made me just, I can rule Scotland by my pen. Like, oh, just dead. Anyway, don't get emotional, Kelly.
He set the base for this to be carried out even today.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly.
Second-class nation, second-class citizens and everything.
Yeah, it was just like, it was just, he, for what he believed was most important, he ruled from London. And then, and he never even, so part of the reason why he promised to come back every 3 years was so that he could have meetings regularly with the Privy Council. They could discuss Scotland in and of itself. But that obviously fell by the wayside as soon as he got the big crown. So yeah, that's another reason to essentially, I think a lot of the things that come up with James a lot of the time is he just kind of turns his back on so many things, as well as obviously I can get being ambitious and whatnot, but you just remember where you came from and remember like
your roots.
But obviously he was one of the he just did not have any interest in doing that whatsoever, which leads me on to the gunpowder plot, which obviously we all know about. I'm not going to go into it in too much detail, but what I thought was interesting was the prerequisite to the gunpowder plot. You know, so one of the things, and I don't know if this is because I was from a Catholic background, one of the things that was always kind of disturbing to me, as much as, I mean, I didn't really know much about it when I was wee, and everyone, you know, had so much fun when you're younger, you know, you go to bonfire displays and everything like that, but you know, celebrating the death of you know, Guy Fawkes and, you know, these people who committed an act of terrorism on Parliament. But, and obviously it's evolved now to be not really so much a religious thing as much as it is an excuse for everybody to go out and get pissed around a bonfire or whatever, so, you know, fair enough. But
priorities.
Yeah, well, exactly. But I think a lot of what I came to discover was, you know, there was, like with anything, there was very real motives that led up to them taking that decision to enact that plot. And one of them, again, without going into too much detail, so the lead up to the gunpowder plot, this is what is said to have happened. So essentially, one of the conspirators called Everard Digby, who is not one of the more well-known names to do with the gunpowder plot, but the story goes that Everard Digby, while Queen Elizabeth I was still in power and Catholics were being very badly persecuted, he is said to have made 3 trips to Scotland while James was still King of Scotland. He wasn't King in England yet. He is said to have made 3, travelled to Scotland on 3 different occasions to meet with James and his council to get a promise of toleration for English Catholics from James before he ascended the throne. And in exchange for his toleration of English Catholics practising their faith, he would... they would give their support, so the Catholic nobles would give their support for him ascending the English throne. These seeds were sown a good few years before Elizabeth I passed away. So, it was under this agreement that Everard Digby then went back to his fellow Catholic nobles and said, look, we just need to hang in tight, we've been persecuted awfully, but, you know, the lengths of persecution were just staggering, and that was something that I never even really knew either until, until ironically, I watched the shout out to the BBC 2017 series Gunpowder, starring Kit Harington, full copyright to whoever it is that made that show. That was the first time that I really like looked into, like, you know, the proper motivations behind it, because when you go to bonfire celebrations, it's just, you know, Guy Fawkes, like, it was an act of terrorism. They're evil, we're celebrating it, but really it was born out of just desperation and really it being terribly persecuted. But one of the interesting things was obviously Everard Digby, who they think had went and visited James on three occasions while Elizabeth I was still alive, he came back to his fellow nobles and said, we just need to hang in, I feel like I've said this before, but I'll just say it, we just need to hang in tight. It looks like James is going to be the successor to Elizabeth. He says he'll be much more tolerant, like he'll practice a lot more toleration towards us. We won't be persecuted as harshly when he becomes king. And is it a shock to anyone that when he did become king, nothing changed? So he didn't practice more toleration towards Catholicism, and the Catholic, so Everard Digby and group Catholic noblemen who were involved in that felt betrayed and felt like he had went back on their word, and this is what led them to then taking the drastic resort to terrorism. So James always denied this, I think, or that's what they think. There's no evidence in terms of written letters from James confirming that he would, you know, be more tolerant if they supported him being king. But it is a large, it comes up numerous times. And it's it definitely makes sense in terms of if them, obviously it was a very extreme resort that they did, but there was so many, like, you know, innocent people who were in that parliament, if we want to go by that kind of terminology. But essentially James was the one who was still behind it all, you know. If he hadn't promised that, or if he hadn't engaged with them or been duplicitous, then that might not have happened. Now obviously there's a certain amount of pinch of salt in terms of, like, some people might say, oh well, there's no evidence that, like, you know, he met with one of the men who would become one of the gunpowder conspirators, you know, that's just hearsay, that's just this, that next thing. But in terms of, if we're looking at motives behind why people resort to drastic acts, and especially when we look at James's attitude previously, it would not surprise me in the slightest if that is what happened. But yeah, that brings an end to my rant / how much I hate James VI. So yeah, I don't know if anyone has any interesting observations to make.
If it's all right, I'd like to go back to my point about the Statutes of Iona in 1609. So I briefly kind of mentioned about the suppression of the Catholic faith in the Highlands and Islands, and the suppression of the Gaelic language and Gaelic culture. But important to this as well is also the plantations of Ulster as well. So there was a fellow by the name of Arthur Chichester, who was Lord Deputy of Ireland, who was one of the individuals that came up with this fantastic idea, which basically to try and control the north of Ireland. Because the thing was, in the north of Ireland at that particular moment in time, in fact, largely across the whole of Ireland, you know, the Gaelic language, again, the Gaelic culture was still very, you know, it was still very vivid. It was very, very rich. And at that particular moment in time, the north of Ireland was still very much predominantly, I mean, very much so, a Gaelic-speaking part of, the whole of Great Britain, or the whole of Britain at that particular moment in time. And one of the ideas by Arthur Chichester was to disrupt and sever the links between Gaelic-speaking Ireland and Gaelic-speaking Highlanders and Gaelic-speaking Scots. So the idea of the plantation of Ulster was that it was going to be a joint Scottish and English venture. So essentially, it was to be a British kind of venture, where settlers were to be moved from Scotland and England to Ireland, to land, particularly Northern Ireland, or the north of Ireland, particularly to land that had been confiscated by Catholic clan chiefs. And they would get these landowners, who were to be called undertakers. And what they were wealthy men from Britain, from both England and Scotland, and even some from Wales, who had money. And what they could do was they could import tenants from their respective estates to Ireland, thereby creating a new population, which would be English-speaking and Protestant. The idea, again, was to solidify the control of Ireland and to make it into, or to attempt to make it into a Protestant-speaking English part of the nation. And again, I think it's interesting to what Kelly's kind of just brought up as well. You know, you can see this kind of persecution of Catholics across the whole of Britain. And I think it kind of, you know, it feeds into this, you know what I mean? As mentioned, Statutes of Iona, you know, you've got the plantations of Ulster. You have, as was kind of mentioned about the gunpowder plot, you know, all of this culminated in the further persecution of Catholics, which is just, I mean, it's horrendous for anyone to be persecuted. I mean, it genuinely is, but it just, it's beggar's belief, put it that way. It's just, I don't know, it's just crazy. So now we've heard how much of a Weinstein that King James was, I'm leaving it to the lovely Maria to bring back some positives to him. So Maria, take it away with the sainthood segment.
Thank you very much, Cam. I want to reiterate my hatred for this character, but I am sadly tasked with having to mention some achievements, quote-unquote, and some positive sides to James. He was certainly very ambitious. He was certainly a character that was quite eccentric. And there were, however, some things that can be considered achievements, and I'm not using this word lightly, only because of the means that he had at the time. So many of this you've touched on before. You know, it's quite interesting to see that as a boy king of Scotland, he had survived four regents dying, violent deaths around him, and there was an attempt on his own life. So that was quite impressive to be able to survive that. I promise you, this is going to be very, very small as a segment. Then the other thing that basically, he's, to be fair, his commitment to peace and reconciliation sort of like try to balance religious divisions, and he successfully held the three kingdoms of England, Scotland and Ireland together for the first time under the one ruler. And you know, after a year after his coronation, James achieved what Elizabeth was unable to, which was peace with Spain. And you know, he did declare a monarchy, a united monarchy of England and Scotland, to be known as Great Britain, with a distinctive flag named after an abbreviation of his Latin name, the Union Jack. Although, you know, we all know my feelings towards that, but still it was an achievement based on, you know, prior history and, again, the means that he had at the time. It was an achievement. And, of course, you know, as I said before, his greatest act of cultural patronage was probably the King James translation of the Bible in 1611. On top of that, you know, what was quite actually exciting to know, and I read, which I found very fascinating at the time, was that although he was notoriously neglectful of his own appearance, despite being shown wearing a striking blue doublet in a portrait miniature that I found somewhere, and he was expecting his people of his court, to promote the Stuart court as the centre of culture and fashion to the rest of Europe. And so members of his court would compete to, you know, show themselves to be, you know, wearing increasingly novel items, such as a frog-shaped purse made from yellow taffeta. So fashion sort of had a bit of a, you know, trend going on during James's era, which again is not a great achievement compared to the monstrosities that took place during his time. But again, there's this side of like eccentricity that goes with his character that I find quite interesting. The other thing that he did was, again, I'm going to mention Shakespeare, like I did in the last podcast. Shakespeare's now celebrated with and taken under royal patronage, and he became the king's players. So James patronized John Donne and Ben Jonson, and then composer Orlando Gibbons. And, you know, what came to be called Jacobean architecture spread to every mansion and manor in the land. And, you know, that again was another big, big achievement in the arts and culture of the time. Ben Jonson was an English playwright and poet. And then John Donne was he's considered to be the preeminent representative of the metaphysical poets. And of course, we all know Shakespeare. And, you know, because he had to appease the new king, Shakespeare, he welcomed the new king with Macbeth, which was written around 1606, which is set in James's native Scotland. And the play portrays the king's real-life ancestor, Banquo, as a good man destined to have monarchs among his descendants. And also we've got the famous witches, which appealed to the king's interests, as Kelly has mentioned. And, you know, his long-standing fascination with witchcraft, because of that, he actually, which is a tragic thing, he considered himself to be an expert on the subject. And it's very likely that Shakespeare read demonology, and that's what he consulted when he wrote about the witch's spells in Macbeth.
In two later plays, King Lear and Cymbeline, Shakespeare appears to be to support James's desire to unite England and Scotland, and that's why both plays are set in sort of like semi-mythical period in which England and Scotland had been a single country, known as Britain. And we see a thing in King Lear that the decision to sort of like divide Britain into three separate kingdoms has terrible consequences, which some people and some scholars mostly believe to be a warning that, you know, sort of justifies James's vision of unification. Not many, but these are some of the sort of like achievements during James's time. Yeah, but there's nothing much.
Shakespeare's a really good one, though. At least if James hadn't been so fanatical, at least if there was one positive thing to come out of all the people that died in his, you know, fanatical persecutions, I think Macbeth, because I'd say Macbeth's probably, well, it's one of my favourite yeah. Shakespeare plays. So yeah, like that is a pretty strong positive, I think.
But this is like the only positive, except for if you say, I mean, to be fair, I like the idea of like having the English male being, you know, adorned with lace collars and wigs and pantaloons and stockings, which is quite, you know, interesting fashion-wise. But yeah, nothing obvious that it has to do with the way he ruled. And the peace thing was quite good as well. But it sort of like masks all the other monstrosities that took place during his time. So not too sure about that.
As someone from the deep south of England, I would argue that the whole peace thing is really very important.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, staying on the positives, yeah, peace is good. Peace. Let's all do the peace sign. But
Peace,
yeah. But certainly, I think, for me at least, from all that I've heard, and thank you so much for all your research, that was really interesting. The most important thing is that what Kelly said about the parallel between like what started off at the time of King James and what's happening now, which is, although the division, the, you know, the unification of the nations came about as an example to, you know, as an effort to rule better and, you know, for the greater good, let's say, the fact that he turned his back on his fellow men and his country is showing its implications even now, which is sad.
Kelly, did you do the thing that I instantly did there, which is just think the greater good?
Oh, chill out, hot fuzz.
There was one other thing I was actually going to say as well. It's very interesting to see, because we've discussed about kind of James and discussed about, you know, his good points, well, what good points there were and the bad points. And I think it's interesting from kind of a Scottish perspective as well, to see the effect that he has had on Scotland even today. When you think about kind of like football in Scotland and sport, particularly kind of like in Glasgow, you've got, you know, Rangers and Celtic, you know, it's this kind of old rivalry. Dreadful. Yeah. It's, I know everyone goes, oh God, you know, but it's true though. It's interesting to see the kind of like, you know, his kind of, or the policies that were enacted in his era and the kind of after effect they've kind of had on and the continuation to the point whereby you get to today's kind of society. As much as I personally think sectarianism, it's not obviously been like, you know, it's still there. But I don't think it's as, you know, it's as bad or it's as prevalent as it once was, But it is interesting to see that kind of like his policy and, you know, the implications of that have affected kind of like Scotland. Even looking at Northern Ireland as well, you know, we had the period of the Troubles, you know, Protestants essentially versus Catholics, you know, Catholics, or, you know, not all Catholics, not all Protestants, obviously, but predominantly people that saw themselves as being Irish were Irish nationalists, were Roman Catholics. People that saw themselves as being Unionists were traditionally, you know, Protestants, individuals that were, you know, there to serve the crown, you know, maybe their families going all the way back, you know, possibly started with the plantationers. So it's interesting to see his actual, you know, what he's actually done, James's kind of, you know, policy.
Yeah, he's definitely, as much as he was, you know, as I've said before, a garbage man, Yeah, he's definitely, in terms of like the repercussions of his reign, are definitely still, they've never really quite went away. And even, like, I mean, we're obviously, I know we've been talking for quite a while, so we're not going to go into it, but even just like the colonisation of Virginia as well, that's a whole other thing. So his effects are felt over in America as well. So if we're talking about monarchs that, for good or bad, have a certain notoriety that lasts down the ages, I think James is definitely up there.
Well, thank you very much for tuning into our podcast. It's been a great delight to discuss James VI, James I. So without further ado, that'll be us. Anyone would like to say goodbye?
Goodbye.
Goodbye. See you next time.
Bye.
That's bye from me. Goodbye.